Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Detroit Lions Breakdown Podcast. I'm Joe Kania. With me, as always, is Eric Schlitt, and this is the USA Today Lions Wires podcast.
Yeah.
And here we talk about all things Lions. That was the first shot at that. We'll work on that intro as time goes by. It may take me another 8 weeks before I figure it out.
That's fine. We got time.
Have it. Yep.
We got time.
All right. So today's the first day of summer.
Yeah.
June 21st or whatever it happens to be, 2018.
Yes. Yep.
And it is certainly a summer day outside. We've braved long, cold winters,
Yes. Even
a long, cold spring, and then a really hot spring at the very end. And we're inching closer to training camp, you know, maybe 5 short weeks away. I made that up.
5 or 6.
Yeah.
End of July, 27th, I think, is the first day.
But until then, we have the Canadian Football League to tide us over. Just learned that Montreal Alouettes are led on offense by Tyrell Sutton and B.J. Cunningham. So a couple of Big Ten guys. Looming. All right, anyhow, we're here to talk about Lions. First things first, we're going to talk transactions, as we always do, because also there's no injury report this week. But transaction-wise,
nothing
happened. This might be the first time ever
in
2 years of our show.
Yeah, honestly,
or
1 year.
Well, we're in year two.
I seem to remember there being transactions last summer, too. So, yeah, nothing this week. There was a hire, but it was not a player.
The hire was upstairs. Jimmy Ray III was hired as a senior personnel executive. I do have to note, because we will link to Eric's article about this, he buried the lead. Jimmy Ray III's father, Jimmy Ray II, he was the quarterback at Michigan State, most famously during the game of the century, the 10-10 tie with Notre Dame way back in 1966. And he led the team during that era quite distinctively.
Yeah, I noted he ended up being a coach at MSU, and then he was a Lions coach where he coached running backs in the late 70s. 40-plus years coaching.
But we have to know, this is not the guy that was
by the team. Yeah, yeah. But the point is that with Ray II being that long in coaching, Ray III has been around football his whole life. And, you know, the connections to Michigan are there if we look for it with the whole MSU and the Lions coaching stint from his father. But Jimmy Ray III, he's a former NFL wide receiver. He turned into a coach in the late 90s. He spent got his first job in the scouting department in San Diego. Spent about 17 years there. He spent a lot of time working his way up the system. And he's one of the guys that's been noted to sign big name guys from San Diego, like Eric Weddle and Michael Turner.
The Burner Turner.
He was the guy who scouted and pounded the table for them. In 2012, he got an interview for the Bears GM job. Didn't get it, and instead then left and went to Indy for a promotion where he became the VP of football operations. Was there for 4 years, and then he left and joined the Texans, where he became the VP player personnel and assistant general manager. He took a job from Bruce Gain, who had left Houston to go to Buffalo. After one season with the Texans, he had an opportunity to interview for a GM job in Carolina. The Texans themselves had their GM, Rick Smith, step down, so he interviewed for that as well. Excuse me. But he went back to the Texans went back to Gain, who had only left a year prior, and they brought him back in, and they wanted him, and they hired him as the GM. And Jimmy Ray stayed on staff, help run their scouting department. He stayed with them through the draft, and then after the draft parted ways. So he became a coveted guy around the league. He's been interviewing for GM jobs for the last 6 years. He seems like a good GM in waiting, and he ends up landing in Detroit. So it's a good hire for Detroit. Right now, they technically have him kind of like fourth in line, but he's going to be part of a four-man crew that works with Bob Quinn that is going to be, you know, the cohesion of the whole scouting department, both player personnel, pro scouting, college scouting. It's all going to kind of intermix with these guys. Those guys being Kyle O'Brien, who's Quinn's right-hand man, Lance Newmark, who was a scout not too long ago with the Lions, but has worked his way up to director of player personnel, and then Brendan Proffitt, who took over for Newmark when Newmark got promoted last year at his director of pro scouting gig. So they've got five guys now, when you include Quinn, that all have a background in scouting, and all of them have like almost a decade each. And some of them more than that as scouts. And so there's a really nice contingency at the top of the Lions front office, all with good scouting backgrounds, both college and pros. And it's a really neat system that they've built together. Now, how long will Ray stay around? That's going to be, you know, hard to say, because like I said, he's been interviewing for GM jobs for a while. But while he's here, he's going to basically be like a liaison. He's familiar with the college scouting department, so he's going to work with them. He's worked with coaches, which should be included in his role here as well. And then he'll intermix them with the front offices. So it's just going to be basically his job will be keeping all these different departments on the same page and moving in the right direction. So there's some neat things to like about this guy. It's an interesting little hire, and it's another good, smart mind to put in the front office. So it's going to be quiet, and it's going to be a footnote in some aspects, but this could be something that, 9 months from now, when we're talking about scouting again, he could be a vital part of that.
All right, I'm going to mention something that would infuriate, maybe confuse Vince Lombardi. Okay, so we got Bob Quinn,
yeah,
general manager.
Correct.
And he's got four guys below him.
Yes.
Their job titles. Senior personnel executive is one.
Mm-hmm.
Vice president player personnel is another.
Mm-hmm.
Director player personnel is a third.
Mm-hmm.
And then director of pro scouting is a fourth.
Yep.
Three guys have the word personnel in their title. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's a chain of command in the three.
Yeah.
But isn't that crazy? Look at this, this big nest that we have in the front. This big web of
people
involved in the front office and decision making.
And there's a definite hierarchy with O'Brien, then Newmark, and then Proffitt. Those three guys go in order. And Ray is there to kind of help keep that cohesion. And when you look at the Lions website, he kind of comes in fourth, technically kind of below them. But this is a guy who is familiar. He's going with the inner workings of a GM department. And he has the potential to be a GM. So it's another smart mind. And, these titles are just titles.
I know.
So it's hard to follow, and it's hard to really ascertain exactly what each guy does. But I think that's part of the allure of why they do it.
It's the allure of becoming one of them. Nobody really knows what you do. Because there's plenty of people who work there probably go, what does he even do anyways? You know, you're going to hear that a lot in the office.
I'm all a people person.
Yeah.
Office space.
What is wrong with you people? No, I know it was Office Space. I know a lot of people listening might not even know it's Office Space. Yeah. Maybe it's a younger crew.
We might date ourselves.
Yep. Well, we have constantly dated ourselves throughout the show's history, so I don't think this is anything new. All right, next we're going to be talking about the undrafted free agent numbers. Yeah. The money numbers have finally been released.
Yeah,
huge.
A couple of them trickled in when they were noting that the free agents were signing, but it was only like a couple of guys that we actually knew the numbers on, and one of the things that we noted was that three of the four numbers we knew were actually already cut and released before these numbers came out. Now, when these numbers came out, they're actually a bit surprising to me, because in my kind of hierarchy of where I had these guys ranked, it's a little different than the money they got. But typically, when you follow the money, it shows you like what the team's perception of these guys is and what their value is. And the highest guy at the top is a guy that hasn't got a lot of publicity, and that's Brandon Powell, a slot wide receiver/kick returner out of Florida. He got 44,000 in guarantees, and that's a lot for a player. Typically, the rule is if you get over 20, they want you to be a practice squad player at worst. And so getting 44, that speaks to what they think of him. And in my mind, I thought he was basically competition with Jace Billingsley, but Billingsley is turning heads, and he's not. But his name has come up a couple times as a guy who's learning, so they might have big plans for him. Next in line after him is JoJo Wicker. Now, JoJo Wicker is a guy I thought might be drafted. He's that three-technique, five-technique type of depth guy. He got 40,000, and 10 of it was in a bonus. So he's another guy that they think highly of that they spent money to go get. So my favorite undrafted free agent is Mike Ford.
Defensive back from Nebraska.
Yeah, he is a guy who I think could crack the 53 if somebody doesn't pan out. And he got 27.5. So that's nice money that I thought was a pretty generous amount until I saw Wicker and Powell's deals. And then I was a bit surprised. Chad Meredith is a guy we've talked about before. He's another guy getting a lot of hype. He's a guy who fills that jack roll depth. He's been standing out in camp. I wrote an article on him last week.
Very Galloway-in. Galladay-in.
He got 25 with a 10 bonus, so that's another guy that they think highly of. Now, these four guys, I think all four of them, at worst, are practice squad guys. Like, and I think two of them could probably make the roster. But we haven't even got into a couple of the other big names. Like Chris Jones is a guy we haven't heard much about. He's a corner, outside corner, got 22. Ryan Santoso is the punter. He got 21, which is really surprising to me because they don't keep kickers or punters on the practice squad.
He just gets 21 grand.
Yeah, and that's realistically the grand scheme of things is that this is chump change in the realm of the NFL.
Yeah.
Now, but the last two names on the list are also names that I think have shots at the 53, and they're Al-Rashid Benton, who's the Mike linebacker from
West Virginia.
Yep. He's a guy who I think could break in if the depth breaks the right way at the linebacker unit. And then everybody's camp darling is Teo Redding from Bowling Green, the skinny but very aggressive wide receiver who has been turning heads in camp. I've written two articles about him already, and he's just got written up, I think, by the Detroit Lions website today. So this kid continues to turn heads. He got 15 and seems to be like the one that realistically has the best shot of making this team. So we'll see how it goes. But there's a lot of money thrown around for some of these guys. And these are names to know. When camp comes around, we'll start to see where these guys kind of fit in the hierarchy. But if they're getting this kind of money, these are guys that usually end up on practice on the Lions practice squad.
All right, so we got all the nice boring stuff out of the way. And although I find it enjoyable, there's a lot of folks that might be waiting for more of the meat of the podcast.
But you know, the money tells you value. You know what I mean? Like that's
I guess it does because some of it could be because the Buccaneers were offering me 35, mm-hmm. So okay, we'll give you 40.
Sure. Like,
all right, I'm coming.
Yeah, that's true. But if they're willing to buck up and pay a little bit more. Now, to explain how the undrafted pool works, just a little bit more. Each team gets $90,000 in bonus money that they can dole out to their free agent pool. So in bonus money, they handed out $12 million to Powell.
$12,000
to Powell. 10 to Wicker and 10 to Meredith.
The way it reads, they gave Meredith 10 bucks.
But they guaranteed that they can also work guarantees into the contract. So if they cut Powell, it will still cost them $44,000 in cap money, in cap incentive. But they only use 12 of the 90 available in undrafted money after the.
This will go all season.
No. This is just post-draft undrafted guys. You get 90 grand to try and get any rookie that wasn't drafted. You can spend that 90 grand as a bonus. But you can get creative with your guaranteed money to give guys a little bit more incentive. So, maybe they were getting $30,000 guaranteed, but like $15,000 in a bonus from somebody, and then we offered them more guaranteed but less bonus, and then they decided to come here. But so, I mean, there's a strategy to this, but yeah, you know, if they're willing to pay you, I mean, even though 12 of it is a bonus for Powell, he's going to get 44 because that money was guaranteed as part of his contract. So if they cut him, he's still going to walk away with 44.
See, if I'm a cheapskate owner, like, well, football now, it changes so often because it was Khan from Jacksonville. But that's just because he wasn't spending money. Now all of a sudden they're spending money because they got better. There's no real good example of cheap owners, at least not popping off the top of my head. Maybe we'll get some. I don't know, they're not necessarily cheap. They're smart with their money,
okay.
But they always go out and get guys. Me, I'm putting it this way: like if I was the Oakland A's of the NFL, as far as owners wise, I would give out none of that bonus money and just hold open tryouts just for random neighborhood people to come over.
Well, they can do tryouts.
Everybody
too.
Does that, but that would be my first route. Forget about undrafted free agents. We're just doing tryouts.
I guess I should clarify one thing, because there might be some people saying, well, what's the difference between guaranteed money and bonus money? Bonus money is paid immediately. Guaranteed money is paid throughout the year. So, for Brandon Powell, as an example, when he signed, they handed him a check for $12,000. But the remaining balance of the 32 grand is spread out over the 12 months. Or $500
a week.
Or it's paid when he is released from his contract. So there's an incentive to try and give guys a little extra money now to bring him in, and that's what that $90,000 pool is all about.
All right, moving on to the questions. We've chewed up too much time already.
Yeah. People like these nuances. There's some people like these nuances.
All right, Hamza leads off the questions asking, how do I stay entertained over the next six-week break until training camp?
Well, you led off right off the bat talking about how it's nicer outside and there's Canadian football. So you
it's
got
Canadian
that.
Football. It's not for everybody.
There's a World Cup going on.
Yeah, it's been exciting.
And we'll have a podcast each week. And those three things should get you going.
That would chew up about 157 of the 168 hours in a week. Right there.
Well, there you go. We got you covered there, Hams.
And then you could sleep the rest of the time. All right, Brian's question. After getting a broad perspective on how we think Patricia's defense is going to operate with multiple fronts and personnel changing week to week, are there any other teams' coaches doing this besides the Patriots? Wait, the Tigers are in a pennant race, quote unquote. All right. Follow them too. That was not the answer to this question.
That was Hobbs's question.
Yeah.
Okay, with Brian, are there any other teams that follow this system? No, not really. The Patriots are going to be the only other one, and there's a variety of reasons why teams don't do this. There's an implementation of this concept of being able to have these flexible players that can be schemed to do different things. But it's mostly, situational type things that are hard to come by that teams will utilize player. I mean, look, the best example is the Giants. Giants had Kennard last year, and they used him in every spot on the in the front seven. But they never varied. The only spot they didn't use him in the front seven was nose tackle. Other than that, he played every spot on that front seven for the Giants. But they never varied from their 4-3 set because the other players around him were better suited for that 4-3. So a flexible player can allow them ability to disguise things, can allow them, to scheme specific concepts. But being able to implement a full scheme change is very rare. You can only do that when you have multiple players like Kennard that can do a variety of different things. And that allows you to put a personnel on the field that can fluctuate between a variety of different defenses. And teams aren't always built that way. They're typically built to fit in a 4-3 system or a 3-4 system. And it just varies on the concepts of why and coach preferences and et cetera. But you typically see guys fit into one scheme and then that's it. So when you build a team of guys that can fit multiple schemes, it allows you to do what Patricia's doing. It allows the Patriots to do what they're doing, but teams don't often work like that. It's hard to gather these guys and it takes time. But if you look at it, Quinn's actually been doing this for the last 3 years. So he's been building these guys that are position flexible for a while now. So when Patricia comes in, he can implement his defense right off the bat because these guys are already in place. If Quinn isn't here prior to that, I think Patricia has a lot harder time turning that defense into what he wants it to be. But, you know, it is what it is now for Detroit, and it allows them that opportunity to be more flexible.
This is a grand theory you have here.
Mm-hmm.
They're building up to this. This is quite a conspiracy.
Well, you know,
this was the plan all along.
I was asked on Twitter the last night or the night before. I was talking about this concept with another person, not Brian, and they said to me, so does that mean that Quinn was hamstringing Caldwell this whole time, building up to hiring Patricia? And I'm like, man, I don't want to say yes, but it kind of looks like it. I mean, I can't definitively say no either, because the guys that he brought in could fit in Austin's defensive system, but man, they sure fit in this system a lot better. So
see, I'm supposed to be a conspiracy theorist.
No, it wasn't me who asked. It was a person, one of my...
Well, you're like, well, it walks like a duck. Yeah. It quacks like a duck.
Yeah. And it's very interesting how easily some of these guys fit into this new system. And I think it comes from just the Quinn learned to scout a certain way, and he scouted those players. Remember, he spent 15 years scouting and running departments scouting in the Patriots organization. So he is familiar with identifying this type of player. So it really shouldn't be a surprise that that's the type of player he brought in.
All right. The next question is from And I Never Slice, which is either a reference to golf,
yeah,
or they're very unhelpful when it comes to produce.
It's our Bushwood guy.
Oh, okay.
It's from right. Caddyshack.
You walked right on the joke.
Oh,
we'll move on.
Sorry.
How would you attack Patricia's defense?
Okay, so Patricia's defense is multiple, but there's some the interesting things that come with that. One, it's not built on pressure. So basically, their job is their front four, their front six or seven, whatever, however you want to look at it. Their job is to stop the run, and then they basically will not pressure you, but they'll force you into eventually making a mistake. They try and restrict the deep pass. They try and stop the run. They give you a little medium area in the middle to work between, and they basically just try and pressure, and put that consistent kind of like a solid defense out there, and they let you kind of dink and dunk and wait for you to make a mistake. They'll change up fronts and they'll try and surprise you. That will create pressure in a different way. They make adjustments where if they get beat in a certain area, they typically don't get beat in that same area again, which allows them to be more consistent as a defense and help kind of push that offensive mistake system. So basically you have to be able to counteract a lot of what he's doing there. So if the defense is built on you making mistakes, you have to execute. So you can't make mistakes. If their defense is to try and surprise you, you have to be able to do your homework and recognize where might the surprises come from. If something comes up, how do I adjust to it? Know how to check off and when not to. Don't get too comfortable with something that works, because if it works well now, it might not work well later. Patricia will also do mismatches, so you have to be able to recognize those. But as far as like the team in general, they're very young up front. The front seven, they're learning a new system, and they're just young talent overall. So I expect teams to attack that front seven. I expect that secondary to be pretty solid and teams to shy away from going and from testing them. And I think they'll go after the young guys, and I think they'll have to try and like find ways to, you know, recognize what Patricia's trying to do, because the whole defense is built on deception.
All right, moving on from Sean Sweeney. Would A'Shaun's frame and play style make him a better end or zero technique nose tackle in a 3-3-5? I feel like Ziggy and Kennard rushing from the outside with A'Shaun and Hand/Hyder playing end with Sylvester Williams at the nose would be a heck of a front.
Okay, so if we're going to have Ziggy and Kennard rushing, And then we have Ashawn in hand, and then Sylvester Williams at the nose. That's five guys. As I'm re-looking at this, that's the way I read it initially. As I'm looking at this now, I'm starting to think he's saying hand or Ashawn and or hand and or Hyder, meaning it could be one of those three. Regardless, they're going to operate both ways. They're going to rush Ziggy and Kennard. They're going to use Sly at the nose, but they're also going to use Ashawn at the nose. But they're also going to use Ashawn at the 3-technique, 5-technique. So, and then there's going to be situations where they're going to use all of them. Like they have the Patriots had a system where they used three defensive linemen, a defensive end, and a linebacker all on the line of scrimmage, and they used those big guys like Ashawn in hand and Sylvester Williams, all basically over top of the guards and the center. And it's basically a run defense up front. It's their bear defense, and it's designed to put five big bodies right on the line of scrimmage to kind of combat a team that excels in the run. So if they can get those five guys up there, then yeah, that's something that all of them could do. But typically you're going to have that Ansa and Kennard rushing tandem, but Kennard's going to kind of be on the line, off the line, on the line, off the line, whereas Ashawn is going to be a guy that will fluctuate between the two defensive tackle spots. Sometimes he'll be the 5-technique, sometimes he will be the nose. So I wrote an article about where I projected the interior defensive line this week. We'll link to it. But I mentioned in there that while Sylvester Williams has been getting a lot of reps in camp, he only played roughly 32% of the snaps last year. And when you look at Ashawn played like 65. Well, if you add those two guys together, that's one nose tackle. Like those two could rotate between the nose tackle spot and they'd eat up that time. But if you're expecting Williams to play more, I'm expecting Ashawn to kick out the more that Williams plays. And when he kicks out, he'll kick out to that spot that Hand or Ledbetter or maybe Hyder, possibly Washington, kind of want to operate out on that kind of 5-technique role. I really like Ashawn at the 5. I thought that was where he would fit best coming out of Alabama. But he's put on weight. And when you look at him, he looks like he's more, and he looks bigger than Williams, who's like a 330-pound nose tackle. And he looks bigger right now. So I think he's going to be in the nose more than in the past. I think that's what their plan is. I think the way they've acquired Hand and have Ledbetter already in the fold, I think the plan is to keep them at that 5-technique as much as they can. And that would mean Ashawn's in the middle. But there's going to be times, like I said, with that bare front or other situations, maybe where they run a 4-3, where they're going to want to get two big bodies in the middle. And we could see Ashawn and Sly next to each other. But bottom line, I guess, to get back to his answer is, Ashawn's going to do both. He probably fits. I don't know exactly. I think the Lions think he fits better at nose, and maybe he does with more weight. I thought he was a better 5-technique.
All right, the next question is from Arthur Melkor, who states, let me clarify my question from last week. It was about building a team by drafting for the future instead of an immediate need. People complained about Tease, Galladay, and Jalen Reeves-Maybin when we selected them, but look at them now. Last year, Galladay surprised early, but more often than not, teams wait on a player. It was a luxury to wait on Tease and bring him along slowly instead of forcing him to play right away.
So Arthur's question last week was, how come people struggle to understand how to build a team? And I got the idea that it was about the running question, and we went on a whole tangent that we're not going to do again. But Arthur has a point, and I think we were and when we look at the history of this franchise, this franchise has always drafted to get players that fill needs now, and when Bob Quinn took over, he's done that with his first round pick, and then after that he's not done that. After that he's drafted with guys with a more long term plan in mind. And so when you look at like what he's done, his inaugural class was able to produce three starters right off the bat. And that was impressive with Decker, Glasgow, Ashawn. But you know, he was still able to pull another situational start out of that class in Zettel, but it didn't happen in his first year. It happened in his second. Killebrew, Dahl, and Ruduk have roles on this team as reserves and special teams players, but it took a while for them to kind of move into their role. We talked extensively last week about the 2017 class, where we talked about Davis, Tees, and Galladay being starters and how the potential was there for Reeves Maben, Michael Roberts, and Ledbetter to potentially be starters. And for some reason, I completely left off Agnew. Agnew was the seventh person in that class last year, and he was spent starting at nickel. So last week, I talked about how there could be six starters from the 2017 class. There could actually be seven starters out of that class, and seven starters as early as their sophomore season. So that's a really quick turnaround. This year's class, Ragnow starting, and that's probably going to be it. But we just talked about Hand being in the mix to start. And then you're going to have to be patient with other guys. Kerryon Johnson could start by the midseason. But guys like Tracy Walker, you're going to have like a lot of patience with him. He is a Glover Quinn replacement somewhere in the next 2 years. He's not a guy that's going to be asked to contribute. So you got to have, you kind of look at that the same way that they approached like Tees. They're going to put him on the sidelines, or they're going to give him limited experience as they build him up. So, look, I think, you know, when we look at how Quinn is drafting now, he's drafting for guys that he's picking a guy that says 18 months from now, he could be a starter. And I think he started that approach, maybe not in 2016, but for sure in 2017. And we're starting to see the benefits of that class right now.
All right, moving on to Dwight Mitchell's question, which I think should have came first on the list of podcast questions. What's your take on the Gronkowski rumors? I'd take that call personally.
Well, what would you do?
I wouldn't trade for him because he's probably on the downswing of his career. Like, you know,
injured
I always...
a lot.
What?
He's injured a lot.
Yeah, well, there's that too. And, you know, players usually don't come here and all of a sudden become healthy versions of themselves. But I would just, we're getting near the end with Gronkowski. He's a great tight end.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you talk to a Patriots fan, he's the greatest of all time. And, but I don't know. It would be fine they didn't make that move, especially if draft picks were going to be involved.
He's still a top two.
I'd say number one still as a tight end.
Yeah, he's still incredible. You could maybe argue Kelsey is the only one that could challenge him.
Yeah, it's still be the
greatest. But I agree. He's still probably the guy. My impression is that this was an inquiry from the Patriots, not an inquiry from the Lions. The Patriots said, I'm interested to shop him around. Here's the four teams that I trust. I'll call them. I don't think this was the Lions saying.
We already fleeced them on Kyle Van Noy. Let's dump off some of this old stuff on him.
I think it was more, hey, you just dumped Ebron. Is Gronkowski something you're interested in? And personally, I don't think it is. I think that they're moving away from a reliance on a tight end, and they're going to give more of a bigger role to Galladay. And I think they're going to try and implement more consistent three wide receiver production instead of like utilizing that tight end as often. So I don't think he would have been part of the mix. I think the overall game plan was a different direction, even if they were interested.
All right, Andreas Thiel. How much improvement can we expect from Michael Roberts?
I'm expecting some big improvement. Like he flashed some stuff as a senior at Toledo. 46 catches, 16 touchdowns. He's got huge mitts for hands. And he can be a very strong weapon in the red zone. I think he and Galladay could be formidable as red zone targets. And I think he has that opportunity to be that guy. He's going to challenge to start. I don't know if he'll officially be called the starter. I kind of am leaning Luke Wilson on that right now. But he's a very balanced player, and that balance will get him on the field. When we lose Ebron and Fells, and we add Wilson and Toyolo, if they were to do their production from last year, there's still an additional like 300 snaps available. And I think a lot of those will go to Robert. So I think the opportunities will grow. And I'm expecting bigger things from him this year for sure.
All right. Next question from Chris Robbins. There's been a lot of focus on depth this year. Outside of wide receiver and cornerback, which position is deepest? Could we get by with a backup replacing our starter at said position, not at quarterback?
No. I'm going to exclude the safeties because I think he might – I think DBs is kind of part of that cornerback, defensive back type unit. If he's only talking corners, I'd say safeties is the best. But I'm going to push safeties into that group as well. And I'll go running backs just because they have four. And I think that if they lose one, they can cover it. I think if someone goes down with an injury, they can overcome that. I mean, it could be Kerryon, it could be Blunt, right?
Could be all of them.
Yeah, right. But
Zach Zenner could be starting one.
It's
possible.
I think they did
it three times in 2016.
I think they
some acclaim.
They can scheme around a running back easier than they can scheme around other positions. And I think so you can – I like the depth better there. Now, there's better depth on the offensive line, but there's still big drop-off to talent. Not as bad as the drop-off last year, but I think it's better. But I'm still leaning running back.
All right, Brandon Kerr's got a question. Which position do you see as the most valuable because of versatility?
Yeah, look, the Jack linebacker, which is Kennard, that position makes the defense multiple. It's the catalyst that drives the engine here. So that is, and Kennard can play everywhere except the nose. And so he's the most versatile guy. But if you take Kennard off the table for me, I'd say Diggs. I think he can play all those spots in the secondary, which means he might never leave the field. Which is a nice luxury to have with him back there, having that experience at safety and nickel. And so Kennard's probably the guy. Diggs would be next in line behind him as far as versatility.
All right, Sweta Patel. Sweta Patel. Who makes the 53-man roster, Teo or Jace?
Well, I spent a whole bunch of time talking about Redding being a guy who can make the roster, but right now I'd lean Jace because of versatility and experience. I also think Redding needs to add some weight. But Redding's got a shot. I'm leaning Jace for the moment.
All right. Respected Madman asks, how many spots do you feel are actually open on the 53-man roster?
I think there's 37 locks on this team, which means there's 16 guys that could lose their spot. But of those 16, most of them are going to be in because of their versatility or whatnot, or maybe because of the position they play. But I think there's 16 actual spots where somebody could jump up in the rotation. One of them is going to be quarterback. Do they keep one? Do they keep two? I think they keep one. But which one? I don't know. But right there, that's a spot. Right, you're going to figure out. You're going to get a quarterback out of either Rudock or... oh my God, why am I blanking on his name? Or who's the other quarterback?
Oh, Castle.
Castle, thank you. Jeez, Castle. That's how highly I think of Castle, unfortunately. So now that's down to 15. Three of them are going to probably go to running back. You probably give one to Belor. I don't know if that counts as one of the running backs. You got to think Theo and Amir are going to be in there. So could Washington or Zenner sneak in? Maybe, and then that takes another spot away. You still got a couple of receivers, but like with Sveta, what she just asked, so there's at least a couple of those that are going to be in there. But there's going to be a whole bunch of reserves in the front seven that are going to need guys. And, I have question marks on Hyder's Achilles. I have question marks on Washington's role, but they seem to like him with the way that they're playing him. But I could see younger guys like JoJo Wicker push for time at a spot. So, you still got reserve offensive linemen as well to add out of that group. And then there's going to be a lot of flexibility guys. But, I mean, there's a handful of guys who could – there's 16 guys that I wouldn't be surprised if they lost their spot. But realistically – the opportunities are not as vast as it seems by me saying 16, because those 16 spots are split up amongst like 8 or 9 different positions. So it's a deep team. We've talked about this a lot. So realistically, we'll know more when we get into camp, but there's not as many spots as you think.
Next question from Derek. What positions do you believe we're still considering upgrading through free agency?
My personal opinion is that they're done. But if they are going to add a player, my guess is it would be on the defensive line because there's a lot of youth on that defensive line. We've talked before about Ricky Jean Francois and Alan Branch.
Forever talking yeah. about Ricky Jean Francois.
Yeah, and Alan Branch, yeah, another both too. Former Patriots. They could be guys that add depth, but based on the moves that they've made and based on the guys that they've added, and I think they're comfortable with the guys that they have, and barring an injury, I don't think they're looking to add anybody.
All right, we're going to move on to the discussion portion of the podcast. It leads off the question from Brandon Kerr. Here's a Kerr/conspiracy theory question.
This was for you.
The current CBA is set to expire in 2020. If the NFLPA goes on strike, well, with the Lions building in the right direction, could they peak at the point, at that point, and miss the window for Super Bowl? Well, yeah, of course. Well, it would be. I think it would be curse worthy. I think the team still has to get better from where it is now for yeah. it to be truly in the curse range.
A couple more years.
You know, you could claim that the 2006 player lockout was a lockout in hockey.
No. Yeah.
There's a 2005, whatever. You know, the Wings had the shot of winning the Stanley Cup that year. But they're not cursed. It's a different story.
Yeah, no.
And I think, yeah, this would definitely fit in the curse realm. Now, you could argue with me, Eric, I'm trying to get ahead of your point right now, that I could turn anything into being part of the curse. Because only one team can win a Super Bowl every year. And yeah. the odds are against the Lions, even if they had the best roster in the NFL, of winning the Super Bowl every year.
It's an interesting and I guess fun conspiracy theory.
All right,
but
go ahead, keep going. I got a piece to put on.
No, go ahead, go.
Well, conspiracy theory wise, mm-hmm. there would be no lockout or no strike mm-hmm. if the Cowboys were on the edge of winning the Super Bowl. Just wait and see. Like if they're but they're expected to go 13-3 every year.
That would be your big six. Would that include the Steelers and the Patriots? Well,
in a way, yes. But like they're all kind of there right now. I know the Packers are kind of trending in the wrong direction.
Yes,
but they're still kind of. They might go 11-5, 12-4 this year. We don't know. Like they're kind of all already there. Dallas had the one, you know, bright shining star year from a couple of years ago, and then the playoff win over the Lions a few years before that. But they're kind of hovering in the middle perpetually, just over the last 20 years.
Yeah.
Now, if they seem to be on the edge of being in that main discussion of winning the Super Bowl, even though they always are every year, but if it's for real, they'll probably try to avoid that strike.
I think that strike is probably coming because the deal was so sided towards the owners last time. I think what the players' expectations are going to be is that they're going to be vastly different than what they were before. And I think the owners aren't going to want to give as much as the players are expecting them to. And I think we could be in for a problem in a couple of years. Unfortunately, it does kind of line up with the progression of what you're seeing from the Lions, but we do need to see that next step before we can start talking about Super Bowl. But it's an interesting interesting cross section of lines that seem to be headed in the right direction for sure.
All right, now moving on from that question, we're going to talk about our discussion topic from last week.
Yes,
we're going to finish it off. This is a Paul Jackson question. You know, his original question mentioned that how the 2018 Lions, or we've talked about this, had the deepest roster of our adult lives, but the mid-90s teams had better starters. And he wanted to hear us compare and contrast the teams. Now, last week we did the offense of then,
yep.
and we picked the 95 Lions versus the offense of now.
Yeah, we gave, all the skill positions to the 95, quarterback to the current. And we were torn on the offensive line, but we edged a little bit towards the Lions with the offensive line. But everything else seemed to favor the 95 team.
Yeah, well, and that offense was also first in yards and second in scoring, which last year's Lions offense, it was in the top 10. But
yeah, but that 95 team, we spent some time last week talking about how Mitchell, as bad of a quarterback as he was, the numbers he put up were relatively parallel to except for completion percentage. Last year. Yeah.
Except for completion percent, but it's a different game back then.
Yeah, and so how, even despite being a bad quarterback, he was able to statistically achieve beyond what he should have been capable of.
All right, so versus the 2018 Lions, they were 7th in points scored and 13th in yardage.
There you go.
So obviously the 95 now, Lions had a big edge in that area.
This isn't to discount the current offense, because I think the offense is the strength of the team, of the 2018 team. But
strength
that 95
team, but it's not great.
Yeah, but that 95 team
at the end.
That 95 team could put up points on anybody.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right, now moving on to the defense, and I believe that 95 defense was ranked in the area of like 17th. Herb Patera was the defensive coordinator. He didn't last long doing that job.
Yeah.
And now we're going to talk about this defense will be led by Paul Pasqualoni, but it's really a defense he inherited from Terrell Austin. First, the 95 team, for a refresher for everybody, that had the great Robert Porche at the main rush end position, although I believe he was hurt during this season because he only had 5 sacks. And on the other side, a great what-if player who would fit better playing today's game than back then's game, Tracy Scroggins, was always a tweener. He'd probably fit better playing an outside linebacker position today than he did playing defensive end back then. In the middle, they had the great Henry Thomas, who would line up on an angle, you know, right in the A gap there. I don't know if you remember that. They used to call him the under tackle. They made up they made up the position for him. He had 10.5 sacks. That was back in the day where defensive tackles sacked the quarterback. Cortez Kennedy, Warren Sapp used to put up good numbers.
Yeah.
Vikings. I'm thinking Randall McDaniel, but that's the wrong side of the ball. Who was
John Randall.
Well, John Randall. Yeah, there we go. That's where the Randall comes from. And that was also the rookie year of Luther Ellis, who played the other defensive tackle position. Although he didn't register any sacks, we all know he became a lot better player as time went on.
Oh, yeah. So comparing them to this defensive line is a little bit challenging because of the flexibility, right? I mean,
Tracy Scroggins could play defensive end and outside linebacker.
Right, and that's how you have to look at it. You're looking at Porche versus Ansa and Scroggins versus Kennard.
Well, I'd rather have Porche.
I mean, honestly.
He would, over time, he was much healthier and much more productive.
and again, Ziggy's a good player. Yeah, he's one of the better defenders on this team, and he's one of the better defensive ends out there. But Porche was one of the top 5 in the league at the time. Like, he was an absolute monster off the edge. And Scroggins
never got his due.
No.
Because of Bruce Smith and Reggie White, like the all-time greats, were playing at the same time.
Yeah, he was always behind those guys. Now, while Kennard has more position flexibility, Scroggins was more of a see ball, get ball, go get him type of a hybrid rusher. So, again, you know, we're yet to see what Kennard can do in this scheme, but Scroggins, he was almost 10 sack a year guy at that point, so at that time in his career. So, again, the defensive ends line up well. Now you've got Ashawn, and then you're looking at Sly or Hand or Ledbetter, like we just talked about, but, you know, they can't produce at the level that Henry Thomas did with those 10.5 sacks because, again, we talk about it being a different game. So, beyond that, though, like, they weren't as strong. Where we look a little bit stronger with our reserves up front. You know, the 95 defensive line looked pretty strong.
Yeah, and that was their calling card.
Yep.
Even though they really lacked, I mean, obviously they're very good on offense. They lacked on the defensive side of the ball, but that blame was always placed on the secondary.
Yep.
Because the front 7 could rush the quarterback. Now, continuing to speak about the front 7, Porche played in every game that year.
So yeah,
he must
down
have
here.
Been a nagging injury.
He had a down here.
Yeah. Now, linebacking core, Chris Spielman in the middle for the 95 team.
Comparing him to Davis, it's a no-brain. Spielman was, you know, he was the best
linebacker. He's a hero to many middle-aged Lions fans today.
Best linebacker this team's ever had.
Well, slow down with that. Joe Schmidt is one of the great linebackers that ever plays in the Hall of Fame. But that was from the 1950s.
Now we're talking about a completely different
era. Nobody considers that football.
Well,
so it's all right.
In the relative NFL era,
the modern era
that we know.
Yeah, yes. The modern era.
Yes.
Michael Johnson played one outside linebacker position. He was like a free agent pickup that year. He didn't play with the Lions.
Here's where they fall off, because they got Johnson at the linebacker spot. When they used a third linebacker, it was Tracy Hayworth.
Tracy Hayworth, who never became much of anything.
And then Stephen Boyd, who was a popular name taking over for Spielman down the road. But again, he was a young Stephen Boyd.
I think he was a rookie that year,
Both these linebacking units are not great. But
and don't forget Stick London. Well, it took years before they started calling him the Stick London. Right. I think he has a XFL championship on his mantle.
Wow.
I think Antonio London was on that LA team.
But again, look, neither linebacking crew was really good. But Spielman is the difference. And the neat thing is this team actually used a lot of five defensive back sets. They used a lot of nickel, which wasn't...
They were in a lot of trouble all the time.
Which wasn't the theme of the NFL, which is whereas today they're using 80% of the time they're in nickel because that's, you know, it's a pass-happy NFL league now. It wasn't like that in 95, yet the Lions were in that a lot because they would score quick and then the defense would get on the field and the defense would get gassed and they needed better bodies out there. So we typically see Spielman and Johnson a lot. But the other linebackers, they weren't out there as much.
All right, so holding up the back end, Ryan McNeil, who's very mediocre number one cornerback.
Yeah.
And then Corey Raymond and Robert Massey, saw them a lot at corner too. Raymond was the other starter. He had six interceptions that year.
Yeah.
Team as a whole had 22, so that's not bad. They did force turnovers that group.
But you know what? None of them are close to Slay.
None of them are Slay.
No.
None of them are Quandre Dix.
No, right. Exactly. And like the 95 team gets the win on Spielman alone, Slay's going to win this for the current roster. There's not a question in my mind. And if you go into the secondary, it gets even... that's really where the next level of strength with this 95 team was with Benny Blades.
Benny Blades and Willie Clay. Don't forget Big Play Willie Clay.
Big Play Willie Clay had 8 interceptions. That's what Slay had last year, 8 interceptions. But I tell you what, I'm taking Glover Quinn over all of them. Yeah, and I loved Benny Blades. Yeah. But Glover Quinn is better than all of them. And then you add Quandre Diggs into that equation, and now it's not even a close contest. So as much as I liked Benny Blades and as much as he helped solidify that middle of the defense for the 95 team, man, Quinn and Slay, you can't touch the secondary right now.
All right, and then the final two guys, everyone knows one of them. Jason Hansen was the kicker.
Talked a little bit about that last week. Yeah,
and how you take Matt Prater over him, and I'm not so sure.
Only this year. Look, Jason Hansen missed 6 field goals, and that wasn't a common occurrence with him. And Prater, as good as he is, Hansen is the punt, is the kicking god there. So I don't think I could lean Prater over Hansen overall, but maybe in this one particular year. Last year had a better year than Hansen had in this one particular year.
You know, it's the one thing I was proved wrong about the curse, because I always assumed that one day the Lions would be in a huge playoff game and the reliable Jason Hansen would be the one to blow it because it's part of the curse.
Right.
But luckily it never happened.
Right.
You know, he never got to play in an important playoff game in the last 15 years of his career. But
I tell you, deciding between these two is a luxury.
Yeah, sure. They had some good kickers. The long term, they've had some good kickers.
Yeah.
Finally, punting, Mark Royals. He was a free agent from Tampa, I think it was, and versus Sam Martin.
Sam Martin on his worst year last year.
Yeah, he was bad last year. It's frightening.
Is better than Royals.
Yeah, he wasn't a great punter. And we're plumb out of time after all that.
Wow.
Yeah, no, yeah,
I like
we chewed up a lot of the scenery.
So, yeah.
It sounds like we love this 95 team too much.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to attribute that to being old, because when you're younger is better, you know, or at least you perceive it that way.
I think this 95 team didn't live up to expectations.
Getting bounced. Their doors blown off in Philadelphia.
Right. Right. But they had players in their prime or nearing the end of their prime that made this team formidable. And it wasn't long after this that the team fell apart.
Right about the end. Barry retires, 3 years later? Mm-hmm. And then they go out with a whimper the year after that against the Redskins in D.C. and that, that was
so
it
while
from
this,
them.
This
then
might
Millen have, showed up.
This was the downside of the 90s teams. This was as they started to go over the hill, whereas the 2018 team looks like a team ascending. And so we're kind of comparing two sides of a hill here as well. But, yeah, this was the final year where the Lions were something else.
Yeah, they were always considered the team that could beat the Cowboys at that time. If there's a roster that could beat that Cowboys team, it's these Lions.
Yeah.
Never happened, except for in the regular season.
quick shout-outs.
Yeah, the shout-outs. Do it quick.
Dan Page from the UK informed us that we have some reviews on the iTunes in UK, which we don't have access to. So Dan himself sent us a review, as well as Cyman. And so we got a couple reviews over in the UK, which are nice to hear. We got three more reviews stateside here from Matt Stafford's Side Sling, Jay Goldsmith, and Restore the Roar. So nice that we continue to build and get some nice reviews. Also got a nice shout-out from the Detroit Lions podcast guys. We appreciate Chris and he had my boss now, Jeff Risden, over there. So want to give some love back to those guys as well. I know there's plenty of room in the Lions podcast world for both of us to do well and exist together.
Yep, and thanks to everybody else who listened who may not have left a review. We still love all of you, even though we don't know who you are.
We know some of you.
Yeah, we know some of you. And
that's it
for this week. Next week, who knows what we'll have for you. But until that time, let's go Lions.